did you most of that?
Really?
Oh, okay. And I missed that.
All right. Well, we're at 6 o'clock. Everybody ready?
Yes.
All right. It is Monday, November 18th, 2019. I'd like to call the Village of Alloway Plan Commission meeting to order. We'll begin with roll call. Connell?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here.
Dart?
Here.
Norris here. Rupp?
Here.
Nyberg?
Here.
Item number 2, modify, adopt the agenda. If anyone has any changes or additions to the agenda, please note them. If not, if there is a motion, I'll accept that.
Motion to adopt the agenda.
Okay. There's first. Is there a second? Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Item number 3, minutes from October 28th, 2019. There are no changes to the minutes. I will accept a motion.
I'll move to approve the minutes.
Okay, first, is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Item number 4, announcements. Trevor?
None.
No announcement. All right. Item number 5, public appearances. The public appearances section of the agenda is authorized by Wisconsin Statute 19.84.2 and allows members of the public the opportunity to bring items not specifically listed on the present agenda forward. Committee shall not take action on matters raised during the public comment period if the subject was not on the agenda. If anyone here would like to come forward, otherwise I'm assuming we're good. All right. Moving along. Item number 6, action regarding presentation of the public draft of the zone code by Duncan and Codometrics. Do you want to start us off, or Leslie, or someone?
So as you know, we've been working on getting to this point for about a year, a little over a year now. But here tonight to present the initial public draft is Leslie, and Kirk Bishop, both our consultants that have been working with us on the code. Heather and Penny, as well as Mark Schumacher, who represents the Economic Development Committee, have been present throughout some of the process to kind of make sure that we're staying on track and not going way outside our comfort zone. So, Leslie, Kirk.
Thanks, Trevor, and good evening, Madam Chair, Plan Commission members. Pleasure to be here. I'm Kirk Bishop. This is Leslie. We're very happy to have the opportunity to finally be before you to give you a sense of what we've been up to for the last year. As Trevor said, three of us in this room, or three of you, two at the dais and one in the audience, have been serving as our work group and are a little more up to speed, but we've been wanting for some time to have an opportunity to present to the Plan Commission. I think Trevor said you invited some of the elected officials as well, who are not members of the Plan Commission. And we're at a sort of critical juncture in the process where we're really beginning or at the point where we want to enter a more robust public review phase for the project. But we thought it really important to give you an overview of some of the major changes that we have proposed in the new code, keeping in mind that this is but a draft. It is one of at least three drafts of the ordinance that we'll be preparing. So if we've not got something dialed in correctly, or if we've kind of stepped out of the comfort zone, as Trevor described it, there is ample opportunities for us to fix that and make adjustments going forward. So when we were fortunate enough to be selected to work with the village on the zoning ordinance update, we had the RFP, the request for proposals for the project, as well as some of your comprehensive plans and planning documents, established some pretty broad parameters for what we wanted to accomplish. One of the first questions we were asked is, should we simply try and make strategic amendments to our existing zoning code, Chapter 475, or should we do a comprehensive overhaul? Our first inclination at the beginning of the project was that the ordinance is showing its age. It's really not been comprehensively revised since, I think, the 1970s. And so our decision or recommendation to the village and the work group is, let's go in and do a pretty comprehensive overhaul. And so that's what is being presented in the draft ordinance that we're calling the public review draft of the document. We're also made aware that you've done a fair amount of planning, a comprehensive plan dating to 2016, 2017, I think, and some other kind of focused planning efforts that we wanted to really try and implement through our zoning ordinance update work. And so we've endeavored to do that, tried to really dial these regulations in to really fit Alloway and be sort of place, we call it place-based, to really reflect the character of the place, of the community, rather than just have a generic set of regulations that could be plopped down in any community or in any sort of commercial shopping area. So we think that you'll hear tonight about the ways in which we think we've tried to capture both the existing and desired character of some of the village's key areas. Better accommodate mixed use, walkable urban development to really distinguish Alloway, and provide some additional housing options. And since we're in there overhauling the thing, we really hope to make the document a little easier to use, to navigate, to understand by adding illustrations, by reorganizing the way information is presented, and we've tried to do that throughout the process as well. So those are very high-level objectives for the project. We're going to tell you tonight about some of the ways that we think we've accomplished that. Our overall work plan involves really five key phases of work. We spent the first few months of the project really grounding ourselves in an understanding of the village and its neighborhood areas. The reconnaissance and diagnostic phase, that resulted in a what we call an assessment and project direction report, where we established some fairly high-level objectives for things we wanted to accomplish. We've then been working over the course of the last 9, maybe 12 months on an initial draft of the ordinance, working with our work group and our staff partners from the village. And that has resulted in where we are tonight, and that is having what we consider to be a pretty solid, though still evolving, public review draft of the zoning ordinance, where really I think we're poised to begin the new calendar year in about 6 weeks or so, to begin a fairly robust opportunity to get the draft out there in the world, let people know it's available, let them know we're accepting comments, hold some kind of open house or workshop type meeting so that we can tell people more about what's in the document and answer any questions that they have. And then, based on what we learned during that task three phase of the public review process, prepare another draft of the ordinance that will take through the public hearing and adoption process here, you know, maybe mid calendar year next year. I would think would be a realistic kind of time frame for when that would occur. Spending the first 60 days or so during that public review process of next year. So tonight, we're going to, as I say, kind of hit the high points of what we consider to be the major changes that you need to be aware of, that we invite you to ask us more questions about or learn more about, working with Trevor in the days ahead. And we're going to begin with probably the most significant new feature of the document, and that's really here in Article 3, these new mixed-use districts and some of their accompanying building and design regulations that are captured in Article 9 of the code. And Leslie has really taken the point in preparing some of that. She's a specialist in preparing these types of walkable mixed-use standards that really, truly are dialed into the specific character of the community in which we're working. So I'm going to start with that, and then I'm going to hit some of the other, what I consider to be high points that you should know about in terms of changes that are proposed in the draft.
Okay, so as Kirk mentioned, we did spend a good amount of time looking at your comprehensive plan, but also the Webster Avenue corridor study, the streetscape concepts that were created for the village center or town center to help develop these regulations. I'm going to quickly go over the zoning districts and then a little bit about the design standards that are in the zoning districts. So this is the new map, or actually this is sort of the top half of the new map. I blew it up so that we could kind of look at the whole. So it's split here at, is it 171?
172.
So we're looking at this part of the map, the northern part of the map. In terms of the new districts, we've created a series of what we call mixed-use districts, and the X in the district name refers to the fact that it's kind of a mix of uses. MX1, 2, MX2, and MXR are the three mixed-use districts that are intended to have storefronts on the ground floor, and then a mix of uses above. So MX1 is the dark purple area that's meant to be the kind of village center area or town center area. MX2 is a lower scale, kind of more cottagey mixed use area, and that extends in the northern part of Webster and at some of the other kind of nodal mixed use commercial areas that you have throughout the village. MXR, the R refers to riverfront. So we have a couple of locations along the riverfront that we're expected to have kind of commercial development that also have sort of the second face to them that is the riverfront. So they're fronting on a street, but also fronting on the river. Then the next two districts that you see in the key are GX, and the G refers to general. So we have a lower scale general mixed use, meaning office and residential, so it doesn't have a requirement for storefronts on the ground floor. And then GXR, which is a general district that is along the riverfront. So these are the sort of navy blue that look very purple on this screen, but that are kind of navy blue up and down the riverfront. The last mixed-use district that has an X in it is NX, and it's orange, meaning it's for the kind of more multifamily residential development. So anything that you see, even things that are currently a PDD, are color-coded with the NX district. So multifamily apartment buildings or townhouses around the village are NX. Kirk is going to talk to you about the R districts. So we have three R districts, R2, R150, and R175. And then we also have two districts, the PI1 and I think we're going to call them P, just P, mm-hmm. Public 1 and Public 2, that are the green spaces. And like your current zoning map, we are showing all of those green spaces or public spaces as color-coded. This actually looks like it's yellow, but it's really green if you look at your map. So anything that's green on your map is one of those P districts. So the southern half of the village shown has riverfront, obviously, along Riverside, and then a little MX2 node down here with the grocery store. The Village Grill. Yeah. So this Village Shops, that's right. So this other MX2 node here. So those are all new zoning districts that are mapped across the city and as across the village. And so as I was kind of referring to, we've identified the building types that occur within these new districts. So storefront buildings, as I said, have a storefront ground floor. So they've got a higher level of glass on the ground floor and then upper story residential or office uses. They tend to be built up closer to the sidewalk. And so they are highly walkable areas. So this is an intensity that might occur in your village center, your town center, and then the lower scale might occur in your mixed-use nodes. So similar to the village shops or similar to what exists on the northern part of Webster or down at the southern tip of Webster. Commercial cottage is, there's an example from the northern part of Webster where you've got what was essentially a house that's been converted to commercial uses. And we see this happen across the country. And what happens is they tend to be modified to allow for storefront, a little bit more glass on the ground floor. This is a great example where they just increase the glass, but it's still up a set of stairs and off of a little porch. So this building form is what we're allowing in the MX2 districts in all of those little nodes. So these areas down here by the grocery store on South Webster and at these little nodes throughout the village. And especially up here on the northern end of Webster where we've got a lot of those houses that have been converted. So it's a character of Webster, many parts of Webster Avenue, that isn't intended to be used in the village center. It's intended to be a little bit more intense at the village center, the town center. So the general building, which would be used in the GX, the office or residential, is a very similar building style, whether or not it's used for office or residential. It just has a similar amount of glass on the ground floor that it does in the upper floors. It may have a raised ground floor, whereas your storefronts tend to be right at the sidewalk elevation. A general building is raised up a little bit. And then row buildings is just a version of the general building which has multiple units and multiple entrances along the street. They tend to be kind of vertically oriented and attached houses, townhouses or row houses. And then lastly, the riverfront building, as I said before, has sort of two fronts. And it's something that we need to be very sensitive to because Riverside may be the entrance that somebody drives up to, but then we really want the trail along the riverfront to also provide a front along the river. So that when you're either on a boat, you're seeing Alloway from that perspective, you're not seeing the back side, or if you're riding a bike up and down the trail or walking on the trail, you're seeing the fronts of those buildings to some degree. So each one of these building types on this table is sort of key to understanding the mixed-use districts. If you look on page 3-3 of your code, this table aligns those building types that I just described with a civic building, which is just a building that's used for civic and institutional uses and is really flexible. But all of those building types align here, and then these are the districts that are mapped on the map. So you would find your district on the map, and then it would tell you which building types are permitted within that district. Then for each one of those building types, the storefront, the general building, the row building, there is a spread in your, a series of pages in your document that are key to that building type. And they're organized all the same. So for each one of the building types, this particular one is the storefront building, there's a front page that has some images that with the working group, we talked a lot about the different images that we wanted to show. It's meant to just kind of convey the idea. This is sort of the intensity that we're anticipating in this location. And then there's two tables on the next two pages. The first table is a building siding, and it's key to this illustration. The second table has height and facade and cap requirements, and those are key to these illustrations. These are the general building form requirements for the storefront. So just like your current code might have setback and height limitations, this has setbacks and height limitations in a different sort of format, but it also has these additional facade and cap requirements that you'll see keyed to the facade elevation. So I'm going to kind of break those two pages down and show you this first page. The table is building and parking siding, and so there's a series of regulations, just like in your current code. There are front setbacks, but instead of a setback, we have a build-to zone. This means that the face of the building needs to be located within this build-to zone. The build-to zones for alleyway are quite deep. You have a different sort of character that you're intending to get here. It's meant to have a little bit more landscape and streetscape area based on the streetscape plans that were done by Somerville, right? So this idea that we would have a fairly deep build-to zone. So this is this area right here, this number two, this yellow swath on any street front. We're asking that it be set back. The building starts back quite a ways to allow for plenty of room to do streetscape, seating, planting, and so on along your streets. So other than places like if you've been to downtown the pier, where the buildings are built right up to the sidewalk, that's not what we're going for here. We're going for a little bit more space in there, for a little bit more landscape, because alloy is a little bit lower in scale, but also has more of that space between the buildings. So these key regulations, the build-to zone, the primary frontage coverage, which means how much of that building facade is covering the front, so you don't have a little building and then a big wide parking lot. You've got something that's going to draw you down the sidewalk and keep you walking along that street. So that's what that's about. And then just like you would normally have, we have side setbacks and rear setbacks. Then we also have where your parking is permitted on the site. So the idea in the town center is that we don't want to have parking lots along the fronts of the buildings. We want that to feel walkable and comfortable. So what we have are these small side yard parking lots that are meant to be kind of nestled between the buildings so you can kind of pull in and access the buildings. If you become more intense, you can infill that and have even more building frontage along it. But for now, we're allowing that kind of pull-in and side yard parking that's limited in its width, and then parking in the rear. So those are the key regulations for locating the building on the site. And all of the building types have that, but of course it's different for each one because they have a different role. Then height is measured in terms of number of stories, minimum number of stories, maximum number of stories, and then a floor-to-floor height for each one of those stories so that you get that feeling that there's people in these buildings. These buildings are built for the scale of the human. And you can see the windows, and the people are actually inside the building kind of looking out the windows, occupying the buildings so that they're keeping their eyes out on the street and making the street safe and active. And then, as I said, the most unique aspect of these kinds of building regulations are the facade and cap requirements key to a sort of diagrammatic elevation. And the idea here is that we have a minimum amount of what we call transparency, which just means windows, but it could be windows inside of doors, too. So it's that permeability of the building to the sidewalk, so that when you're walking down the sidewalk, you can see into the buildings, and people that are in the building can see out into the sidewalk. So that creates a more comfortable, safer, and more active space. So that's the minimum and transparency requirements on the ground floor. For the storefront, this is how we get storefront buildings, is we have a much higher requirement for transparency on the ground floor than we do in the upper floors. For your general building, you have the same amount of transparency required on the first floor that you do in the upper floors. office buildings might not have as much glass on the ground floor. Residential might not have as much glass on the ground floor. You can put more glass, but you don't have to. And then the other key part of this is the location of the entrances along the building facade. So we don't want to have a whole lot of blank facade with no windows and no doors going in and out of the sidewalk, because then you have dead space along your sidewalk. You're not drawing the people down the sidewalk. And so that's the second most important part of the facade. And then the last is the cap. So we like to cap the building so that they're not just ending. With this, we have a whole series of caps that are illustrated. The idea that you're finishing the building off so that the building has a kind of a base and a middle and then a top. So even though it sounds like a lot, it's really pretty simple and straightforward. We're doing building and parking siding. So we're locating the building and we're also locating the parking. We have height in terms of stories. And then for the facade, we have windows, doors, and a roof. We also have facade materials and then some building details and location of mechanical equipment and how mechanical equipment is treated in Article 9, I think it is, and I'll show you that in just a brief minute. But these regulations all together make up the building design requirements so that your staff doesn't have to negotiate a whole lot between what the developer is developing and then what they're submitting. So the idea behind this is that we're putting it all down on paper so that they can design it right the first time. They can get all of these things that you're asking for the first time and don't have to bring it before the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission says, no, we want you to use higher grade materials. They have to go back to the drawing board, pay their architect to redesign it, come back before you. The idea is that we're getting it all down on paper so that it's much easier for the developer. They're more interested in coming here because they know it's an easier process. And then you guys are getting high quality buildings in the end. So just to briefly talk about a couple of the other building types, just the difference between the commercial cottage and the storefront building is the commercial cottage is much smaller in its building footprint. It has a cap, a roof cap that is pitched to match the different building forms that you have in these areas. And so it's meant to kind of be a smaller scale along the street. It can be connected, so you can have two cottages that are connected, but the idea is to maintain that scale. And then in terms of the riverfront buildings, we've laid it out so that you can treat the trail and a portion of Riverside as front, or you can introduce a perpendicular sort of primary street that's meant to be access to the riverfront, but lets you really serve that as your entrances so that you have a kind of L-shaped series of entrances and then only a portion of Riverside. So we've kind of laid this out with the realization that you're not going to be able to get fronts along all of the riverfront and all of Riverside. There is a section about building siding, and so this is in Article 9. This is pages 9-3 and 9-4, again laid out in a table form. We have a series of major facade materials and a series of minor facade materials. And again, this is just a way to get as many of those materials out there to say how we would prefer to see them utilized. We have asked Somerville Architects to take a look at the building materials, and they have. And we haven't made any of those revisions yet. But the idea is, again, to have a smaller sort of menu of major materials and then a really broad menu of sort of minor, smaller amounts of materials so you can get a lot of variety in your building forms. This section, Article 9, also touches on principal building entrances, balconies, awnings, and, as I said, mechanical equipment. So those two sections, those two articles, Article 3 and Article 9, are the mixed-use districts. So Article 3, mixed-use districts with all the building form requirements, then Article 9 with building design regulations in it. There's one more article that we have that defines what we call a master development plan overlay. This is for sites that are 3 acres or more, So this is for areas that you might get new development in. For example, if the site next door, next door to us this way, or one of the sites back here, were to redevelop in the future, we would want to sort of introduce a block structure so that it would be more walkable, as opposed to just these big, huge areas that you can't get into unless you drive into the parking lot. So this overlay would allow someone to, or actually it requires anybody who is creating a new development on 3 acres with a new street to use, it has a series of blocks, and it defines block regulations, and it defines a sort of typical base street that has all of the components that make a street. And this could be a private or a public street. It doesn't have to be dedicated public street. But the idea is that we want it to include sidewalk and street trees as part of it. So that if somebody's building a new driveway into the site, we can call it a private street, but have all of these components so it feels like a walkable street as opposed to a driveway. The other part of the Master Development Plan overlay is these open space types. So we have defined a series of actual usable spaces, not just sort of leftover green space, so that if somebody develops this larger acreage, that they are including one of these usable plazas or a green or a greenway or something like that in the development. And then lastly, it requires a mix and layout of zoning. It allows a mix and layout of zoning districts. So what we've done is there's a series of master development plan types based on what their existing zoning district is. And then all of the allowed zoning districts, which are essentially all of the districts that you have on the books on this draft are then either permitted or they may be a certain amount required. So in a mixed-use master development, you're required to have some of the storefront mixed use. For a mixed residential master plan site, you're required to have some of the NX district. And you can use some of the other districts to create a mix of building types on it. So the idea is to avoid the sort of big swath of development that's all in one thing. And I think that's it for me. I'm going to pass it back to Kirk.
So I'm more of the old school zoning guy. I'm going to talk to you about some features that are in your zoning ordinance today and aren't as kind of new in approach as what Leslie described. I'm going to start with, you remember the zoning map. I think we have it here. Leslie explained the X districts, as we call them, the mixed-use districts. I'm going to focus initially on the residential districts, and the first thing I want to draw your attention to is this new classification. You have today an A residential zoning classification, which is your essentially your single-family detached house district, and then you have a B zoning classification, which is often thought of as the duplex or two-family zoning district. One of the changes we're proposing is to break that existing single family, think of it as the A district, into two flavors. One that maintains the existing 7,500 square foot minimum lot size, 75 feet of lot width or frontage. But there are portions of the village that come up short in terms of those minimum lot size requirements that are functioning as single family areas and are often zoned in the A zoning classification. But when property owners come in for it to do a new porch in addition to their house and kind of work on the property, they're told, you're non-conforming under our zoning ordinance and may need to go through some hoops in order to accomplish what you want to accomplish, which is kind of a pain. And it's particularly where it's kind of widespread. For example, here on the north end of the village, where our analysis shows there is a fairly widespread phenomenon of lots smaller than the 7,500 or 75 feet of lot frontage that are zoned in that classification that makes them legal, but in a non-conforming way. And so we've elected to create a district that would sort of reclaim those lots as legal conforming lots, and thereby sort of lessen the burden on property owners who are trying to do sort of regular things that that residential owners want to do from time to time. And we're calling that the R150 district. By and large, its highest concentration is up here where the brighter yellow is, but you'll see other instances in the zoning map where we find that this R150 single-family detached classification is a better fit for lot patterns. And therefore, that is one of the key changes in the residential districts chapter. That's the second article of the zoning ordinance draft. Some other changes that you'll see in the residential part of the ordinance is we've offered up a new building type. It, from the street, looks like a standard two-family building type, but we're calling it the twin house. And this is a kind of a not terribly uncommon building form in within the region and certainly within Wisconsin, where it's essentially a side-by-side two-unit building. But rather than two units on a single lot, there's a property line down the middle. We call that the twin house. There aren't regulations in today's ordinance that specifically enable that. If you wanted to do that today, if you wanted to draw a lot line down the middle of a side-by-side kind of duplex, you'd have to come in for a small handful of variances probably to make that happen, because you're not going to comply with the side setback regulations, particularly along that common or abutting sidewall. So kind of a minor change, not going to represent any dramatic change, but it will simply make it easier for owners to decide to have two-unit attached houses in a kind of fee simple ownership kind of situation. We are also proposing, and as with really all of the provisions in this ordinance, we're kind of continuing to think through and tweak some of these. But for the moment, we've proposed a reduction in the minimum lot area for two-unit houses. So that R2 classification, that is your existing B district, it also has several instances up here and in other areas where you see that kind of mid-range orange on the map, some lots that don't meet the existing 9,000 square foot minimum lot area for R2 units. Given the village's stated desire and some of its planning documents, and given our analysis of existing lot patterns, we think it's worth considering of reducing that minimum lot area requirement for two-unit houses down to, we think it could be as low as the 5,000 square feet required for R150, but certainly down to at least the R175 level. We find no strong, compelling reason for lot sizes to sort of go up and down just based on the number of units in a one or two unit building. And so for that reason, we're proposing a reduction in the lot area requirement for the two-unit houses, particularly where it's an up-down situation rather than a side-by-side. Where you're trying to put two units side-by-side on a lot and do attached garages, you do need a more spacious lot in order to accomplish that and not create one of these snout houses where you can't even find the front door. So if we continue down this road and this idea of a reduced minimum for two-unit houses seems to be acceptable in the village, we may have to write some design regulations to ensure that there aren't sort of misapplications of a smaller minimum vis-a-vis the attached garage type situation. We've also proposed, and all of these are proposed for discussion, for your consideration. Wouldn't be the first time that our initial recommendations are rejected, but we've proposed an elimination of the minimum dwelling size regulations in your existing zoning ordinance. All of the residential zoning classifications in the current ordinance establish dwelling size, minimum dwelling sizes for whether it's a, depending on the number of bedroom units or the type of dwelling. And those can range from a low of 400 square feet to, trying to get my computer to respond here to remind myself, as high as 2,000 square feet. We find that in some older ordinances like this one, minimum dwelling sizes were adopted many years ago as a kind of proxy for the type of quality or as a kind of substitute for the kind of quality type design stuff that we're trying to work with. The other thing is it works against the sort of changing nature of household sizes, of lifestyles, of income levels, of seniors. And so for all those reasons, we think it's worth considering whether those are serving you well in here in the, you know, as we enter 2020. And so have proposed, as we do in a lot of our client communities, that you consider eliminating those minimum dwelling size restrictions from the residential districts. Another potentially big change, if you're interested in pursuing it, is something that is known in the planning community as the accessory dwelling units. And we've proposed, for at least for discussion purposes, at least two different types of accessory dwelling units. And these are small secondary dwelling units on a lot occupied by a single family house, a detached house. And as I say, we propose them in a couple of forms. One in the form of a sort of detached accessory dwelling unit that we're calling the backyard cottage. And that could be above a detached garage that's already in the rear yard, or it could be in the form of a small standalone building in the rear yard of a single family house. The other form is what we call the secondary suite, and that is simply a secondary dwelling unit within the same building as the principal dwelling unit, whether it's an addition to an existing house, the conversion of attic or basement space within a house, could take many forms, the secondary suite. By and large, the regulations that we offered up for your consideration have several features. It makes clear that you can only have one of these accessory dwelling units, whether it's a backyard cottage or a secondary suite on a lot. Can't combine and have two, so that the number goes to three. We have proposed that no additional parking be required on the lot, because we find that one of the ways, the idea behind these accessory dwelling units is that they can be introduced into existing neighborhood settings without really changing the overall character or feel of the neighborhood. Because you still, as you walk up and down the sidewalk or drive up and down the street, see a detached house. And whether it has a rear yard cottage or some kind of space within the house that's a smaller dwelling unit is really not evident for those on the street. Requiring that you add a bunch of new pavement to the lot to accommodate additional parking is one way that sort of character disruption can occur. So for that reason, we propose that no additional parking be required. We've also proposed that the owner of the subject property live in either the principal dwelling or the accessory dwelling as a way to allay concerns about absentee landlords and property maintenance and the kinds of issues that can arise with when you introduce all rental housing, or that can occur. I'm not saying it always does occur by any means, but that can occur, that the owner live in, again, either the principal or accessory dwelling. There's also additional limitations on the height of the backyard cottages. Overall limit of no more than 700 square feet as a way to kind of control for the number of people who might move into these places and add unnecessarily to the, you know, to the overall occupancy of the property. Secondary suites have similar limitation, no more than 25% of the principal of the of the principal dwelling's floor area can be devoted to the secondary suite. Has this, and of course, both of them have the owner occupancy requirement. So that's a big one. We found growing acceptance of this. There was a time, I've been in this zoning game for a long time, longer than I care to remember, and there was a time where this was a kind of a light, could be a real lightning rod. In terms of introducing it within residential settings. But we found that there's really growing acceptance for this. First, we found that in today's world, the cost of building out even small amount of accessory dwelling space with plumbing and all the amenities that you have to make it a dwelling unit makes this not a small matter financially by any means, so that this isn't something that is likely to catch on like wildfire and that every lot in the neighborhood is going to have one of these things. The other thing is that it makes sense in terms of today's changing demographics as we age as a population. It allows property owners to remain in their primary neighborhoods for longer than they might if they didn't have someone to help them care for the property and do overall maintenance, or mom can maybe move to the backyard cottage and the younger generation lives in the principal dwelling. There's a lot of iterations you can imagine for this. College students moving, the boomerang kids that we heard about in the last decade need a place to live that's maybe not as close to mom and dad, and maybe above the garage makes more sense. So there's all sorts of kinds of changing trends that make this, I think, a little more acceptable in today's world. And so we felt like it was our job to sort of bring it to you as a proposal and see if it's something that we could dial in to sort of fit your values as a community. Leslie also mentioned when she showed the zoning map that we do have these new public zoning classifications, and we're going to simplify the name and just call them that, our P districts, as it were. As the draft stands right now, we have two flavors of public zoning. It's the neighborhood scale, which is kind of a small single lot. It's a library, church or religious institution within a neighborhood, or larger campus scale type public and civic type of uses. And these, as I say, could be parks, religious assemblies, say schools, an obvious example of something that may require more land area and be a campus scale, kind of different regulations depending on the scale of the project. One of the things you'll quickly notice is that the way we've kind of reorganized and presented the zoning information is a little different. One of the ways that manifests itself is in this. This is a page from our consolidated table of allowed uses. Rather than have a sort of page-by-page narrative list of sometimes antiquated uses that are allowed in our districts, we have a table that's pretty easy to read. It relies on more updated and more modern classifications or definitions of use types that exist in the world today, and tries to keep those classifications pretty generalized so that staff, as technology and business, as changes occur in the business environment, they're able to find a home for new proposed land uses within this overall structure. So the table is presented just as Leslie's building charts, building type tables were presented. Districts along the top, uses along the side. You find your zoning classification, look at your use type, and find out whether it's permitted only above the ground floor within some of those mixed use type settings, or whether it requires some conditional or special approval, or whether it's just an outright prohibited uses. We've also got a column, and all of these are sort of clickable links, so if you hover your mouse over these things, it'll immediately take you to the definition of what a club or lodge is, as opposed to a safety service type use, which is a police or fire station for the most part. So they're all linked to those definitions. All the terms are defined. And there's also links to any supplemental regulations that apply.
to these use types.
When it comes to the parking chapter, it's presented in a largely the same way. The essence of it is a table which shows by land use type what the village's minimum parking requirements are. We have modernized those, and that's planner speak for reduced the minimum parking requirements for many land uses. Parking can be a real impediment, particularly in a community that's, you know, largely built out and is redeveloping in a, you know, with constrained size lots. Parking can be an impediment and sometimes difficult to challenge. So we like to keep the minimum requirements pretty low and provide a lot of flexibility for owners to say, even with these reduced minimums, offer up some ways that they can reduce them further by doing things like providing employee bike parking within the building, or saying there's parking that's permitted on the street in front of my building. Shouldn't I be allowed to sort of count those spaces towards my minimum requirements? If I provide space for a car share vehicle to park in my parking lot, can I count that in some cases towards the requirements? So we provided a whole lot of flexibility in that parking chapter with those objectives in mind. We've also proposed for the first time new bicycle parking requirements. Not the in-building employee bike parking, because that can be a little more difficult, but just a basic bike rack for land uses that are likely to generate at least some measure of bicycle traffic in terms of customer visits to the site. We're continuing to think through those and simplify them. I think they're maybe a bit too complex in their present form, but the basic notion is we think it's important to have some bicycle parking requirements, short-term bicycle parking requirements, and we think it's pretty much consistent with the village's approach to multimodal approach to transportation and the trail system and the like to have convenient, safe bicycle parking for folks when they get to their destination, if it happens to be a business or some type of use like that. Eliminated the requirement for attached garages and multifamily covered parking. So the reference to the attached garage, I think the existing zoning ordinance, as I recall, requires that all the residential buildings have an attached garage.
Correct.
Or that's how we read it. And we certainly have done nothing to prohibit folks from having an attached garage, but we think it seemed inflexible and potentially adding some design limitations to infill development that might be unnecessary. Similarly, for the multifamily covered parking, which is required in today's ordinance, we found that in our estimation, that's something that adds perhaps unnecessarily to the cost of constructing multifamily, multi-unit residential projects, including the type of above ground floor mixed use kinds of configurations that Leslie was describing. So we offer up for your consideration the idea of eliminating both of those requirements under the ordinance, recognizing that you may decide that there's good reason to retain those requirements. New stacking requirements for drive-through uses is something you also find in the parking chapter. We have added a new section detailing some pretty straightforward objective requirements for the planting of street trees and some parking lot landscaping for larger projects under this ordinance, something I think that you're getting now as part of your normal site plan review and negotiation with the developer. But our attempt was to kind of spell that out in more objective terms under the ordinance. I think the village arborists have an opportunity to look at it. We've gotten some comments from Trevor. We've made some necessary adjustments there. I feel like it's a pretty reasonable approach. Sign regulations have been consolidated, collected into one place, put in a new Article 10 that deals with all the sign regulations of the village. As is true throughout this document, I'm sort of hitting some kind of major changes. there are countless technical adjustments and tweaks throughout the ordinance, but by and large, a lot of the existing sign regulations that live on, they've presented in a reorganized manner. We've also attempted to sort of clean up some legal issues with the existing ordinance that every older sign ordinance has, and that is basing some regulations on the content of the sign rather than the physical aspects of the sign. You have some regulations, for example, that talk about for sale signs. And the definition is a sign that advertises a property for sale or lease. That seems very logical and intuitive. But what the courts have told us is that that's not a valid distinction because you're telling the owner of that property that they can have a sign, but it has to say one thing in particular, which is in violation, again, based on court decisions of the First Amendment. And the courts basically said, if you allow a 4-square-foot sign on your property, you're saying that that's in keeping with the character of that particular site, and you shouldn't be telling people that it has to say this because it has the same impacts whether it says for sale or for lease or impeach the mayor. For that reason, we've scrubbed it of those content-based regulations that could get you in trouble if somebody challenged you on a particular point. It's a fairly minor point, and I think by and large it's not going to have any appreciable effect. But it's something that you really kind of need to do, and it's our job to tell you that you need to do it as part of our work. So, belabor that point. Wrapping up, a new article dealing with all of the approval procedures. When we think about properties that are going through a rezoning process, that require conditional use approval, site plan review, a variance at the Board of Appeals, those are all development and approval procedures. We put them all in one article, kind of presented them in a kind of standard rhythm so that somebody can sort of kind of walk through. We've accompanied all of the written procedures with flow charts. This is a summary table that kind of describes in one table the various steps in the review process for all those things I just mentioned. This is key to a legend. Planning and Zoning Administrator, Board of Appeals, Planning Commission, Village Board, review authority, review decision making, a little asterisk indicating that there's a public hearing. That's the kind of shorthand that's going on there. This is just a summary table, as I mentioned. It's accompanied by detailed explanations of the step-by-step process for doing all those various things and these types of flowcharts that accompany those procedures. A lot of editing for clarity, just making clear so that somebody who's not familiar with zoning or what the process is for these things could pick up the book and know, I understand what I'm going to be going through as I seek to get my variance approved or my zoning map that I really like. To accompany the new mixed-use district regulations and the design standards that Leslie described, we've kind of added some modified site plan review procedures. We have two types of site plans under this proposed ordinance. One that could be approved at the staff level, and that's basically a site plan that complies with all of the regulations. Nobody's requesting any zoning relief, any exceptions, waivers, variances of standards. Those are the types of things that are approvable at the staff level through the administrative site plan process. And then there are public hearing site plans that are a bit more involved. And those would come before you as planning commission site plans. Similarly, if somebody wants some relief from some of the building material set, that build-to-zone requirement, the amount of windows on their building, we recognize that in some cases that's going to present a challenge or
that someone may have a better approach to how to accomplish that. So we've added these design exception procedures, which again authorize at the staff level through a very efficient process for some very minor exceptions to the design and mixed-use regulations to be granted at this level, but for major ones that have the potential to sort of undermine the overall integrity of the mixed-use districts, those would come to you for review and recommendation and on to the village board for final decision-making. We have a chapter on non-conformities, generally just edited for additional clarity to draw important distinctions between non-conforming lots and non-conforming structures and non-conforming uses. It allows a bit more flexibility in terms of for what you can do with non-conforming properties, particularly in the event of accidental damage, an act of God, a storm, a fire, or something like that. Current ordinance imposes some limitations on when you can rebuild in the event of that sort of damage. And we find that most communities, if they think about it, are pretty sympathetic to somebody who suffers an accidental loss or some kind of damage due to an act of God beyond the control of the owner. So this non-conformities chapter is revised to say you can rebuild to what at least what you had before without having to go through or jump through a lot of hoops, just as kind of a reasonable approach. Enforcement, basically not a big change from the status quo. We've added a few remedies that are available to local governments under Wisconsin law, just to make sure you've got a full menu of enforcement options that you can use to eventually get voluntary compliance with the ordinance, ranging from kind of administrative things like holding up permits for folks that are in violation to more more robust types of enforcement actions that we always hope doesn't come to that. So I know we apologize for being so long-winded. We probably should have come to you in more bite-sized chunks to introduce this to you, but we wanted to be sure we give you a pretty clear picture of the types of changes in this. We really enjoyed the process today. We look forward to rolling it out and having a conversation with the broader community. And I guess what we're kind of hopeful tonight is, or maybe it doesn't have to be tonight, but to tell us whether you think what you've heard seems like something that's ready to go, kind of prime time, and for us to roll out and get some general feedback. And then of course, we'll report back to you about what we've heard. And I certainly invite you to participate in that public review phase. Yeah, and of course, happy to answer any questions you have tonight, or you kind of want to digest this a little more.
Yeah, I think this is really good. It's obviously a lot for everybody to digest when sometimes it's like the first time that people have been hearing it, but I don't know, I feel really good about where we are so far.
Yeah, I do too. I think my first impression is, the format is logical, the tables are good to have, otherwise you can go crazy trying to match up a bunch of specs on three or four different sheets of paper, and it looks like it could be easy to use, good tool for us to make our and others' jobs easier. I think the suggestions and proposals are good. Some of them I've recall being discussed at some of our meetings. I think the second dwelling, the mother-in-law units kind of thing. I mean, we have neighborhoods where those exist, and it's come up in discussions. I think it's well worth pursuing. So those are just my first thoughts.
I also think the whole format gives so much more flexibility to the sites and so much more opportunity to the sites that we do have.
Okay.
So our thinking again is it's just kind of is we know we want to just based on continuing to look at it and read through it. We know there's a couple of additional changes we want to make just to clean things up, basically. And so here by mid-December, I think we'll do that. And then we think our intention would be to just kind of make the draft available to the public, put it on the village's website, maybe get it in a local library, get a copy here at the front counter, or a flyer just saying there's the public review drafts available, point them to the website, things like that, and then say that we're going to open up a public review period that starts, and I'm just making up numbers here, that you know maybe starts on January 1st and would conclude on February 15th or March 1st, and during that window of our public review period, as it were, I invite people to email Trevor or you know village offices, however you want to set it up. I'm just blue skying here. We can make the draft available in a format that allows people to embed their comments right in the document. And so during the middle of that public comment period, come to town, hold an open house, kind of informal open house where we've got some posters or boards on the wall, and we're available to answer any questions that people have. And if there are groups that come forward and you know maybe want a little more love, that maybe Trevor could go out and do a little road show for them, and tell them what's in the draft. I'm volunteering. I didn't broach that subject with them. So, but that's kind of how we would approach this next phase. You know, again, kind of coinciding with the first of the year, just kind of kick off that public review phase and see what we hear, and then at the end of that, we can report back to you about what we've heard. And we certainly would invite you to attend the open house and offer up your comments in the same way. You get it down there to the people who are really in charge.
So, a couple of things that Kirk and Leslie both brought up. I think over the past 2 years, for sure, if not going back further than that, there's been discussion on, as things have come before the commission, the parking requirements was something that was discussed, and I know at one meeting it was discussed at great length how the market actually drives a lot of you know what is needed versus what we should dictate. Bicycle parking has been brought up numerous times. And then, of course, the nonconformities and the... So I think a lot of that's been addressed in here. But as you all recall, look back and reflect on various projects that you've seen or have experienced over the past couple of years, those were the ones that came to my mind. But if you have additional ones, you certainly want to discuss that now this time, or if maybe reflecting back at those certain circumstances that I just referenced, if maybe the code doesn't address the issue the way that you thought it could, or you know something like that, then you know those are comments that we should be discussing as we move forward. But overall, it seems like from tonight's opinion that we're on the right track.
So I wrote down a couple of little things that about like the parking requirements, like lowering the limit and the sort of elimination of the covered or detached parking requirements. And you know, previously to owning a home in the village, I also rented in the village. I mean, I'm a person who likes to entertain a lot, and you know, when you live in an apartment and there's you know very little parking requirements for the residents, you know, maybe even one spot, and say you have even, let's say, five people over and there's nowhere for anyone to park, that's a really frustrating thing as like someone who rents, or you know, if you own a home like I do now, and you know, obviously you street parking and things like that, but you know, like, just from other people's perspective, you know, who live in the village, you know, whether they rent or own a home, you know, I think that can be a frustrating thing, you know, for them living there. If they're like, well, I want to have guests over, but there's nowhere for them to park, and now they have to park, you know, like, if there's not street parking, especially if it is, you know, November through March, and now they can't park on the street, things like that, you know. And, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, we have to, you know, write the code for, you know, our renting residents who want to have parties, but you know what I mean. You know, just be sort of mindful of those things and sensitive to that. And then the other thing I wrote down was, you know, over the last 3 or 4 years, we did rewrite the sign code, things like that, and we have had many meetings where we've talked about, like, billboards and things like that, and I wasn't sure, because we didn't really touch on it tonight, about, like, billboards and, like, our... We don't want to have them. I think we have, what is it, that we're down to 2 billboards in the village?
3. 3?
Okay. Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know where we are sitting with
that part, but... Yeah, we retain the prohibition.
Okay.
We're at least as strong going forward.
Okay, I just wanted to comment on that.
Yeah,
so.
No, that's a good question.
Okay. That's all I had.
We're not eroding, we're not reading, not... One of the things that we purposely decided to do is because you all have worked so hard and we know how difficult sign regulations can be, we purposely tried to keep our hands out off of the good work that you've done. And so it's really more of a reorganization and representation of the existing sign regulations. With that caveat of those few things that violate that content neutrality principle, but other than that. Good question.
Great job on the presentation. Really, I think everything seems very logical. And the biggest thing for me is just that it's user-friendly. Because if it's not user-friendly and very confusing, I'm not going to look at it. Especially, you know, the chart at the end that you were talking about, just walking through the zoning process. As an architect, I so many times have to go into communities and ask, what is your zoning process? When are the meetings? Because I don't know the steps of getting approval, so having that user-friendly towards the end of the document, I think is great. One thing, you had mentioned eliminating the minimum dwelling size requirement. Can you speak a little bit further about that? I mean, is that opening it up to any possible fads? By that, I mean tiny houses or... extreme example here, but if I want to convert my camper into a permanent dwelling, I mean, are we going to run into any examples like that?
Well, if it's stick-built on a foundation and complies with the building code, including the building code as, like, occupancy, they have some size requirements in the building code. They're far lower than the zoning numbers that we're proposing elimination. So it is possible for somebody to build a tiny house. Although that wasn't our intent, and we're not sure that's going to be a widespread phenomenon, particularly given lot prices, that somebody would intentionally do that. As for campers and wheeled vehicles, it doesn't open the window that far. But that is one potential. You know, it's possible for somebody to build a much smaller house. Absent these minimums, which, you know, again, depends on the number of bedrooms, but if you're talking about a 3-bedroom house, existing minimum was 1,000 square feet, which is, obviously it's not a very big 3-bedroom house. So we've seen some that are more unreasonable, much more unreasonable than these. It wouldn't be the end of the world if you elected to retain those, but we just kind of felt they were a vestige of another time, and something to at least throw out to you as something that not a lot of communities are doing anymore.
Or even the 700 square foot requirement that you had for the secondary.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it prevents you from building a tiny house that's 350 square feet.
Through that.
Well, I think if you have, like, a lot, if it's a lot size minimum, if it's a resident, it wouldn't pay to build a 300 square foot house on a lot with 75 feet of frontage. You'd want to put a lot of them on there, and that's not allowed to have that, you know. So
that's true.
I mean, one on a lot wouldn't necessarily be.
So it wouldn't be real practical
yeah.
or wise.
Yeah. But if it were to say that you could, there's no minimum on how many units you could ask in a lot, then that would be something different.
Now, given the limitation of one dwelling unit on a lot, and perhaps one plus the secondary if we end up going there, it would be fairly impractical and kind of a counterintuitive economic decision to decide to build a 350 square foot house where you could have had 2,100.
I would also hope that as an architect, you would particularly look at the building design regulations in Article 9. As I said, we've asked Somerville to look at the building materials.
That was me.
Yeah. Oh, you were at Somerville.
No.
Oh, that was
me.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks. We have two people from Somerville.
Yes.
You guys are well represented.
Yeah, I really like, because I think that we need to encourage, because of the lack of available property, that we need to encourage redevelopment, and that we need to encourage denser than we have now. And so I think that it's really encouraging to see these things. And I think that, like the garage and the parking requirements, there's going to be so much change in transportation in the next 50 years that I think we need to be kind of looking to that, to what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Are there any other comments or no?
I think we're good.
All right.
Cool. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for being here.
And welcome. As you continue to think more about this, please coordinate through Trevor, and because this is very much a work in progress.
Thank you. Okay, moving forward. Item number 7, report regarding discussion, village projects, and property updates.
Really, the only two projects that I'm going to update tonight. Number one, the embodied, you drive by the building, you see we're making very good progress. Still looking at opening really next year. Probably February time period is what they're shooting for. And then the second one is the Old River condominiums. Anywhere from 3 to 5 heard have sold. Definitely 3, but also as many as 5. So I believe they have 4 units constructed at this time, so obviously going to continue to move forward with that. This weather is kind of dictating how quickly they can move forward on that project, but we're still looking at constructing that trail connection then in summer of next year. So,
awesome. Okay. Item number 8: report discussion regarding village update or updates from village departments.
Not much going on. Major, I did mean to, and Sean Gein, I don't know, many of you probably do not recognize him. He was the gentleman sitting in the audience. He's our new public works director as of 2 years now. So
now that.
Yeah, exactly. So I should have had him, had I thought about it ahead of time, provide an update. Public Works Committee just discussed yes, Riverside Drive, and I know that's been a kind of discussion, and in a lot of ways it led the discussion for the corridor study back in the 2015-14. But Greg, you were at the public works meeting, right?
Well, in particular, we were looking at pedestrian access, the crossing, and St. Joseph and Riverside Drive. The DOT came back with the Cadillac plan of $1.7 million for pedestrian crossing. So we've asked them to revisit that and give us the Chevy Chevette version, and something a little more simplified that would require land acquisition. So we'll be waiting to hear what they have to say on that. Public Works, well, I'll finish a little bit more on Riverside Drive. The DOT and our conversations with the DOT is they'll be doing another repave of Riverside Drive with the intent of another 10-year extended life or 7 to 10. So realistically, we're probably looking at the 2030-ish time period to when Riverside Drive may be reconstructed. So we were in such a hurry a few years back, and we're going to wait. Another project that will be coming forward, that we're still working on the design, is another stormwater detention pond behind Bethel Baptist Church. That hopefully will go out to bid January-ish, maybe even before that. That I think would be our 7th detention pond that we have in the village, which kind of leads me into a meeting we had, and I don't think we discussed this. Bay Lakes Regional Plan Commission organized a meeting here, as well as with other communities, to talk about East River and projects that could be undertaken along the East River, which would be the invasive species removal, replanting of trees, to public access, to kayak launches, to you name it, it's a possibility. And one of the projects that we have identified as a priority, medium to high priority, would be an additional northern pike spawning along the East River, and try to utilize the new detention pond as an area that this could be taking place. So Trevor put together a nice long list of projects that we would like to see. Again, some of them are pedestrian related, connecting the East River Trail to the Fox River Trail. Crossing over the river is even one of the projects that we identified. So there was a wide variety of projects that we felt that were worthy of at least putting out there, because there is a group that's working on trying to come up with funding mechanisms. So.
Is that where the survey came out from that group?
Yes.
Okay. Did they compile results from that yet, or is that where those ideas...
I have not seen any of the results come forward yet, but hopefully throughout the course of the winter we'll see some of that. And as far as identifying some projects for next year for Public Works street projects, it's going to be Garland, one half of St. Mary's, the west half of St. Mary's 1 year, and then the east half, the, doesn't make sense, the north side, and then the south side, I'm sorry, of St. Mary's, due to the cost of that street. And I think there's about two other streets that will be standing, and maybe about that. Kind of a little update. Can't think of it in the parks, but some of the projects they're working on. We do have, we had intended on doing the redoing the parking lots in Green Isle this past year, but time got away as well as the weather, so that will be done next year.
And one final thing with relation to parks, it was brought up during the budget cycle. The community center on Webster Avenue is in need of quite extensive repairs. So the village board has asked staff to kind of compile a list of what's needed, what are potentials, or just all-around report on the issue, if it makes sense to even hold on to it. I think that's kind of the discussion that they're looking toward, although no decision has been reached yet, and I don't think it'll be an easy or quick decision either, but I'll continue to keep you guys updated on that as well.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Item number 9, next meeting date and future agenda items. Would we be looking at the Monday before Christmas, or are we potentially
doing
that? Right,
it would be December 23rd, so previous Monday to that.
There's also a Packer game that night.
16th is a Packer game?
On the 23rd of December.
Oh, okay, all right.
The Minnesota game.
So,
so
did you suggest we go on the 3rd?
Should we move to the 16th?
The 16th? Yeah, mm-hmm. The 3rd Monday.
Oh, yes.
Not the 3rd of December. Not next week or whatever.
Yeah. I guess, are there anything coming up that you know of already?
Not offhand. There are things in works, but nothing yet would be certain.
Okay. The last thing is tomorrow night is the budget hearing.
And
is that something to do?
I think it was later this week on Thursday. There's something at, is it St. Matthew's?
St. Matthew's,
for the
Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
6 to 8, I think it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Item number 10, adjourn. Is there a motion?
Motion.
Is there a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We're good. 7:27. Thank you.